2157. Our first witness is the Attorney General.
We finally have a house there. We can look at it.
From the law, and we did in fact the attempt to the proposed bill is actually broader than what they have now. And the one they have now is limited as time, where ours is limited as discussion. Amendment number 11, Mr. Chairman, I understand Mr. Gill will be here, is an amendment which was drafted by my office. It regards the state act of insurance fund. And, Chairman, I just don't think it's appropriate for me to take a position as to whether the type of records FAIF is attempting to remain confidential. It's a decision which I think probably made by the legislature. It's not one I'm really in a position to recommend.
What's the current status of it, Lee?
It would be my opinion that under present law, they probably are not confidential. I think there are very strong reasons why they should be confidential. It really boils down to the question that the State Industrial Action Fund is in a unique position in government. It is a government agency. It enjoys many of the attributes of a government agency, but it is also a very much a competitor in the free enterprise world. And so I would prefer to let Mr. Gill give his reason for that and let you decide if we have Mr. Gill's department and our agency his agree as far as the form of language. If you think that their records are entitled to contempt. Under paragraph 4, I think then brings up basically paragraph 1, 2, and 3 of the memo I give you deal with questions of contempt. Paragraph 4 deals with questions of procedure. You will recall under section 6 of 2107, we have provided for administrative review by the Office of Attorney General. And also in regard to local matters by the Office of the District Attorney. Now, I think there may be some real question in your mind as to whether there should be this administrative review. As I stated earlier, it's our position that we think it is a good thing to have. It's a good thing to try, because one of the big problems that has arisen in every other state and has arisen in the federal government is the problem of what does the ordinary citizen do when he's been refused disclosure of certain documents by a government agency. It's the only choice is going to court. Going to court, even at the initial stages, is an expensive process. This was designed to provide a very speedy administrative review, but you may decide not want that procedure. If you do decide that you want that procedure, you may decide it should go in some other office other than the Office of Attorney General. We certainly don't have any hang-up about this. In fact, if it passed, we're not really sure we want it. We just have to feel that probably the only office in the Senate position to accept that responsibility. We have drawn amendments. If you want to make it eliminate the concept of the administrative review and make it a direct judicial review, we have drawn amendments to that to carry out that purpose. Also, I'd like to mention in the administrative review provision, we had a provision which said that even though there was administrative review, if the records were under the control of another elected official, then they would not be subject to that, and it would be direct judicial review. You may want to eliminate that.
Lee, did you consider legislative counsel?
That's a possibility. I thought about that one this afternoon. I don't know if it's
if you don't think it's really the right for your agency to do it, that would be the only alternative for your agency to do it.
Frankly, we're going to have to do it anyway. They're going to ask us, can they withhold it? And we're going to probably say no. But that is possible. I think the one point you make, Chairman, is it probably should be an officer who is judicially. I suggest very strongly, Mr. Chairman, that you review the exemptions listed in Section 11. You try to cover those as best you can. They are a matter of decision on your part. I repeat, Section 13 deletes the concept of the executive privilege. Our office does not feel this is appropriate in Oregon law. As far as I know, the governor's office is not taking a decision on it. The remaining sections, which make it the great bulk of this bill, are really technical amendments to conform to the first section, the first 11 sections. I'm here to answer your question.
I think maybe we better go through the pleasure ruling out, please.
Fine.
And I want the committee to open, holler, yell, and scream if you have any problems, don't wait for me.
Okay, amendment number, they said amendment number one merely strikes out section 12, which dealt with open meetings, and that's not covered by Senator Hurst's bill, Bill 15. The second amendment number two, came as a result of suggestions by the Revenue Department. First off, was to add a section that in our compilation we missed, our confidential tax records. And secondly, to make it very clear, confidentiality of those tax records remains, even though they may be disclosed to another public office, such as the governor has access to them, my office under certain circumstances has access to them, and likewise, also the Welfare Recovery Division. Because to merely keep that confidentiality, even though it is left in front of the revenue. The amendment number three relates to the bank fund.
It's been a couple of months since we've been through this bill, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if we can go through it again. Attorney General,
okay.
And point out the changes of the amendments to
I think we would consider it of our faculty management all day and even trying to hurry things along, but I think perhaps that's this we'll probably be voting on Senate Bill 15. Excuse us. So we have a member of the committee who's on ways to meet, a couple of them, in fact, in their meeting tonight. So if you see people wander in and out, it's because of other legislative business. Excuse us, Lee, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I will start section two, of course, the definitional. I don't think any of the definitions create any problems. Section three is the basic gist of this bill. Every person has a right to inspect any public record of the public body in this state, except as otherwise expressly provided by Section 11 of the 73 Act. One of the main things we were trying to do was to put one place in the statute book the list of all these things. And also to make it very clear that the prevailing rule of law is these records are public and they are open to public inspection. Section 4 is a directive to all government agencies that they shall provide for inspection of records, that they may make reasonable rules and regulations necessary for the protection of the records, and respect for the interference and discharge of their duties. Section 5 provides that where the request is made, the governmental agency does have a right to make a reasonable charge for any expense that it incurs in compilation, things of that nature. Now, one sentence in there which may give you some trouble is one that we have taken from other statutes in terms of the common practice that it does create problems is the computer data shall be provided in a form determined by the public body. The problem of people want computer data in another form, another one the body has available. Of course, may require reprogramming, things of that nature. This is the language that has been used in most state statutes, and that's about all we have to recommend. We frankly do not have any reasonable alternative to offer. Furthermore, the agency may establish a charge to recover its actual cost.
Yeah. One of the language online is bound to give them. I've never seen that in statutes before. Can you just do shall?
Mm-hmm. I agree. Money may get bound in the mail. Shall provide. Which way do you want
it? Shall give him. John, you agree to me? Matt, quick.
I'm glad to know that once in a while you do make a mistake.
Mr. Chairman, the only question I have is the reference to the certified copy. This generally requires then a comparison of the original with the copy by the clerk or whatever.
Right, yes, they want a certified copy. The agency's got to provide it to them.
Nothing to foreclose, you're just giving them a copy, I understand, if they just want a copy.
No, but if you want to certify a copy, all right, we'll certify them. But likewise, we are entitled to charge them for any cost. My name is Kurt, and I'm here to go to the property and make sure that we actually get them back. Section 6 is the administrative review provision. And it provides for review before the Attorney General. The burden of proof is on the agency, and I think that's very important as to where that burden of proof is to prove that they do come within one of the exceptions, and the exceptions are listed in Section 11. And furthermore, it provides that we will issue a decision within 3 business days from the day we receive the petition. That really is no problem. Frankly, we do not anticipate much cause involved in the review proceedings. It's really a cursory review of the documents and determination whether they come within Section 11 or not. Section 2 deals with the problem, if we deny a petition, then the citizen asking for disclosure can bring an action for the injunctive or declaratory relief in Marion County Circuit Court. If we grant the petition, the agency likewise is a petition for appeal in the court. Section 3 deals with the problem.
Question, Mr. Chairman. We have a bill, in, a couple of bills in the judiciary to allow attorney fees to the party who has to file suit. In other words, if the Attorney General enters an opinion, for example, that public documents should be disclosed and the agency refuses, and it's necessary for the party to file suit, we have a bill that provides for attorney's fees in case you're successful in the suit. Perhaps you'll be building it.
Section 9-3 of Jerry Gold.
Take care of that.
So the person seeking the right to inspect to receive a copy of the public record prevails for the suit, who shall be awarded a reasonable attorney's fee.
Good.
Unless
anybody performing the future law.
I ask you to very strongly that you know, citizen prevail, he should get them. Section 8 is probably quite critical in terms of review procedures. It does not, in this case, this is the case of an elected official. For example, the governor, secretary of state, state superintendent.
Yeah, skip 7, is there a reason for that?
Section 7 provides in the case of local agencies, local government agencies, the district attorney will have the same review function that the attorney general would have with respect to state agencies. Section 8.
We'll leave out the city attorney entirely.
Right, for the reason that. Well, again, we were trying to pick one official at the local level who would be in a somewhat independent status. I put it from the standpoint he's independent, from the standpoint he's independently elected. That, from a practical standpoint, if he denies access, if he rules in favor of the agency to deny access to that record, and then gets overruled in court, he's got a political embarrassment to deal with. And that's the only reason why likewise, the state attorney general is in that position as far as the state goes. Because there is a very practical influence upon me to try to call him very straight, or indeed, and to actually want to call him in favor of the citizen's position for documents. The very reason that I don't know what position that I was overruled by the court. The district attorney is a locally elected official.
The city attorney is going to have to represent the city because you provided the minutes due file, the district attorney shall not serve as counsel for the public body unless he ordinarily serves as counsel for the city.
First of all, many district attorneys do not even represent the county anymore in civil matters. They're represented by counsel. but where they do represent the county, they would, then they may have a conflict of interest. If, for example, the same thing at state level, if I rule against the agency, then that agency should be entitled to go out and get its own counsel to represent on that matter, which is in direct conflict. I run an opinion, an opposite position on that state court. And that's what that is trying to take care of.
Yeah, the only problem I can see is if the district attorney rules in favor of the public body, then the city attorney has to get to sustain that in the suit that's filed.
Right, yeah, that is what's correct. The only thing is, though, I don't think the city attorney is in a position to give an objective or an outside administrative decision on whether the city council properly can withhold that document or not.
They probably asked the city attorney's opinion prior to it, haven't they?
Very likely. They probably asked my opinion
prior to it. Derek, or anybody, any section you're not sure of, just read the text and we'll go back on the work session.
I'd like to repeat. The administrative review provisions in here are not perfect because it's very difficult to find anybody in government who is in a totally independent status. But on the other hand, I think it's very important from a citizen standpoint that they be given some kind of remedy at this level. Because once he has to go into court, too often it just isn't worth the cost. Now, Section 8 also raises the contract. And if you force it down my throat, I will accept it. But I want to know that I propose Section 8.
You opposed it?
No, but I proposed it. This deals with the question of where the record is the record of an elected official, for example, the governor, or the superintendent of education of the Bureau of Labor. In that case, we have provided that there is no administrative review. The only way you can get review is by directing the court. And the reason for this was that we felt that it just creates a conflict between the district attorney and locally elected officials. Or in my own case, in my office, the governor, or another elected official. And that was the reason we invited you.
Any questions on that? Okay.
All right, Section 9 is primarily procedural. Re-emphasizing where the burden of proof is. Emphasizing that if it does go into court, judicial review of it takes precedence on the docket, and finally, there is attorney's fees if the citizen prevails. Section 10 merely sets forth in statutory form the form of petition. We want to make it as simple a form as possible for administrative review. And presumably, in the administrative review proceeding, I would get this one page petition on my desk. We would ask the agency, we might not have to even go this far. We ask the agency to send over the documents that were in question. We'll quickly go look at them and stop one way or the other. The reading should not take much time. And the statute is very clear that I can't take more than 3 days.
Question. Liam, Section 9, line 31 on page 4. To the court having jurisdiction to join the public body. How does that fit in with the claim of privilege of the elected official?
Here, the elected official's privilege doesn't mean anything. It only means as the administrator proceeding before me or the district attorney.
Section 8 and 9?
Right. Section 8 merely says if a citizen files a petition with me for disclosure of records in the executive department, the governor says, those records are under my control, and I claim privilege access to them, then I immediately say, we will not take jurisdiction in this case, then the citizen's only recourse is to the court. The court determines it on the basis of the merits of the argument, not whether it's one
to the. Well, my question was, if line 31 says the court has jurisdiction to enjoin the public body, it doesn't speak to the public official.
Public body includes every state officer, agency, department, and so forth.
So that's in your definition.
Okay. The second aid is not intended to be a kind of service to an elected official except from another elected official at the administrative level. Is that clear, Frankie? Alright, section 11. We read it, this is where we get down to the difficult problem of defining the exception. At section 11.1a, first of all, I'd like you to compare that with. John, where do we repeal the exception through? Section 15? Yeah. Section 13 is an amendment to ORS 44040, and this has been a big loophole in present public records law, which provides that a public officer shall not be examined as communications made to him an official confidence and the public interest was covered by the disclosure. We are repeating that provision. It's far too broad in our opinion, because it leaves up to public officers to determine on his own judgment of what is a confidential communication and what is not. We have, however, entered the provision within 11.1a, which deals with oral communications between government employees and their superiors. The point is here is to permit a qualified privilege, which is subject to a balancing of interest test between the public interest in disclosure, between the public interest in encouraging frank communications between employees. And I think I can best give you an example of this. I'm just simply taking the type of communications I get from my own people in my office. It's not the formal memorandum. So rather than one line memorandum that says, frankly, this case is a lousy case, or some other more graphic term. And if we totally discourage, if all that type of thing becomes immediately available on just a request by anybody to public inspectors, I think what we do is we create a habit in government of not keeping records, frankly, everything starts to become oral. And we have all kinds of problems as a result. I think there is a policy of trying to encourage this type of frank communication. The only kind of communication would be of an advisory nature, and which would not involve in a final decision. Subsection B deals with public records, which are matters related to matters of litigation. The only reason for granting this exemption simply is that if we did not have this exemption, government would be put at a severe disadvantage in any litigation. Because all these records, of course, are available and accessible through the litigation process with the ordinary rules of discovery and statutes that deal with discovery. But we do have occasion where attorneys try to meet the discovery rules and come into us under public records law and try to get our records. And we don't get any mutuality or any chance of getting discovery for their records. That is the reason for that decision. Subsection C deals with information that can't contain in personnel files, primarily medical files and similar files. And in broad terms, it is whether the question of whether the public disclosure of there would constitute an unreasonable invasion of personal privacy. But this would protect most personnel records. It protects them from an outsider coming in and looking at those personnel records. It does not protect them from the person who is the subject of the record. When I came into office, we had a dispute with the welfare division over this subject, and they were relying on federal regulations on a state statute to deny welfare recipients from an opportunity to look at their own files while they were denied the grant. The reason for that law was to protect personal privacy. Well, obviously, you're not saying anybody's personal privacy is there to subject to file. But what the outside interloper person coming in, yes, there is a legitimate
okay.
Yeah.
If the records were relative to a suit, and if it was sued by an individual, he would be entitled to look at his own individual records.
Right.
And then going back
to. Likewise, an employee should have a right to have access to his personnel records.
Is there any possible conflict with B on that if the records are a part of the litigation?
Well, quasi-conflict is not real. If he is asking for, well, okay, as part of litigation, theoretically, the statute we could withhold it until he makes a motion for discovery. We have to deliver it right away. Now, let me make one fine point. It's confusing, okay? Personnel record. It is the present policy, and it would be a policy that would be upheld under subsection D of the personnel division to not reveal to an employee any risk information received from a former employer where that information was delivered to confidence. And the reason for that is the former employer delivered that information in confidence, was not required by law to provide that information. And consequently, it could be withheld under those reasons. That's subsection D.
All right, what you're saying then is that the governmental agency can go through the employee's 201 file, pull parts of it out before allowing the employee to sit.
Right. From the standpoint, if we had a personnel file, and we had in there, say, a letter from a former employer, and the former employer said, we are providing this information and it's not. And then we could withhold the last document on that basis. Now, let me mention that subsection D is a qualified privilege. If the court determines that that personnel, that letter, is of sufficient importance, then we still have to review.
We're assuming that whoever is pulling the documents from the 201 file is completely honest and is not pulling anything out that might be detrimental to the agency or himself.
All right, he has two ways to do. The other way he can contest it, but he's not litigation. Okay, he doesn't believe he's getting the full file. The file decision might also have to turn over the whole rest of it. All right, we try to cover it in some field school. No absolute guarantee, right? Subsection E is trying to cover up a number of common exemptions that you see in every public records law. It is one that is also designed to cover nearly the statutes that we presently have. I mentioned already the Department of Geology, drilling detail. These are trade secrets, as distinguished from patents or things that are information which would be of great value to competitors, business information provided to government. Subsection F deals with investigatory information for criminal law purposes, and the way I understand why they should remain confidential. In fact, I think we are probably drawing statutes now to make sure that they're confidential. Subsection G deals with test questions, scoring being used by your licensing board, and those type of things.
What about, excuse me, what about rating of professors by students?
I think that. I have to refer back by.
Now, bring him up if you want
him. That's covered by one of the statutes in here.
Sit down, John, and be comfortable.
We did not consider the chairman now to the extent that it's covered under subsection D, or the information. Is not required by law to be given, but it's given in confidence. And then the agency is entitled to hold in confidence unless the felony is revealed by the court.
Well, should it be considered further than a considerable push in this area at the present time? I'm thinking of students.
I think there's no requirement that students buy it. So it can be covered in the
requirement for whom to provide information?
Right.
Well, what I have in mind is the rating of a university professor that turned into his department head by the student.
Only the student. There's no law for the student has to find the information. They can ask for that information to the student. And they can agree that any information provided will be held in confidence. Section I. Yates, pardon me. This is designed to cover the whole series of statutes in the Department of Agriculture and also some of your revenue statutes. Production data, sale data, catch records, suspension commission. These are records that are kept solely for the purpose of determining a fee. They are essentially really kind of trade secrets. Our information then are presently kept confidential under other statutes. We repeal most of the statutes regarding this broader language. Subsection I. There was one, most statutes relate to all matters dealing with the purchase of real estate. We did not feel that was justified. We did, however, feel that the state should be able to keep the confidentiality of the appraisal. Actually, our present practice is record profiting on those appraisals, but we don't like to have a one-way street.
In that same regard, Lee, what about bids, contracts, and this one? Is that covered elsewhere?
Simply, we can probably record the
bids. Once the bids are open, nobody can consider this to force somebody to reveal a bid prior to the opening.
You may have raised questions that we better take a quick look at. Johnson, he has looked at it. He's taking a double check on any public records or information disclosure of which is really by federal law regulations, obviously. 137.
Time.
Should there be added to Section J or other state law?
We have tried, Attorney Cole, to list all of those in Subsection M.
How about the county and city ordinance?
We have tried to limit them all in Subsection M.
George, you think of a tough one, and when we get to M, you see it's there.
M of what?
It's not an estate.
We did not think that the county's implant was the only power to determine on that hot paper. Subsection K refers to pretenses. Subsection L deals with information in the corrections division, parole board, the extent of that information that interferes with the rehabilitation process.
All these others are listed in lowercase, right? We make sure that we're going to be written in the lowercase.
Back on page 7, to amendments 4 and 5.
If I can get through section 11, Chairman, then I'll take you through the amendments. The remaining sections of the bill are all sections. 1.440 is judicial fitness commission. 7211 and 7215 are adoption affiliation proceedings. 44040 is your privilege communication. Question whether that section is even needed, but we'll put it in. 146.780 is injury reports received by medical examiners. 173.230 is matters brought before legislative council. 179.495.
Why legislative council?
20 are public assistance records, which are required by federal law to be confidential, but may also the federal law requires to be an affirmative statute. 411.770 is child abuse reports and records. 419.567 is juvenile court proceedings. 432.060 is patient records and morbidity stats that study. 432 is legitimate patient and registration of foundlings. 474.160 is prescription records. 657.665 is unemployment insurance records, which are again required by federal law to be kept confidential. The governor can exempt a class ready from finding a building to use. Right, Mr. Chairman, we have found a whole lot of statutes where where people have meant to get confidentiality in some very broad language. It doesn't mean anything to drive a railroad car right through the full wall. And that's what I'm trying to start.
Well, we come to a work session, Jonathan, I presume you'll be prepared to defend yourself against the co-chairman.
But I really think, Senator Ripper, if you read subsection 3, it does provide in any class record, these records should be examined. You can hold the hearing here in Delft, you're 20 to hold the hearing, we stand there where it should be examined. And then ask you to review the legislature the next day. I think you're going to carry out the real purpose of this bill. You've got to make it that time. Chairman, now going to the amendment. From amendment number 2 first, that merely adds the tax statute that we need to overlook and also make sure that there's no pass through effect on those tax returns. So they are going to another agency pursuant to their debt. Amendment number 3 is designed to take care of the banking sector problem. We have testified to you. We think that we have taken care of his objection. He is out of town. It's a very broad exemption you can invite. Section 4 is really designed to clarify the exemption due with police reports to make clear that arrest reports are the reports that a crime is committed. I'm not essential to investigating the first. Section 5 is merely clarifying language regarding the confidentiality of records needing the assessment of fees. This is an amendment we worked out with the Department of Agriculture. Section 6, we amended the testimonial privilege to make clear that a public official cannot be examined as to records that are otherwise exempt. In other words, I cannot be subpoenaed to testify as to records which would be confidential under the statute. Is that reasonably clear? Amendment 7 is designed to take care of the problem raised by the Basin previous hearing relating to birth certificates. We had originally suggested this provision be repealed, and with our opinion, his testimony was very compelling. Amendment number 8 merely deals with accident reports filed with the Motor Vehicle Division. The policy of the law is to keep them confidential, to not permit their use in court, really. On the thought that we will not have canons report if they do become a matter to be used in litigation. The policy considerations behind that policy are questionable, but I don't think it's worth the bother to get into it. Amendment number 9 deals with public employees' relations board. These are records that are not presently confidential under the statutes, but we think probably should be. They are under the law of the National Labor Relations Board and all through the area of collective bargaining. These are the names, the signatures of employees, and sign authorization cards and petitions for the purpose of requesting representation in a decertification election. The employees are otherwise sign of the subject to coercion feel that they should be protected in much like a hundred thousand. The insurance amendment number 10 deals with the insurance commissioner and their primary protected investigative material and also the name of the person who filed complaints. Amendment number 11, as I mentioned, amendment to take care of certain records of the state of Delphi Access Fund. And then again, Gil is here, and I would prefer to let him testify on that point. As I said, I'm either in opposition or in support of those things. Amendment number 12, I would hold aside if any deals with questions. If you want to abolish or eliminate the idea of administrative review, amendment number 12 would accomplish that purpose. And 15 deals with investigatory information for state filing.
Do you have a recommendation on which of these you think should be secret?
Chairman, we have agreed with the agency's amendments, with all these amendments, other than amendment 11. We agree with the agency, they shouldn't be kind of remain silent.
You would argue then on behalf of any of these except the.
Number 11, I have a very strong argument in favor of the state of your action fund, so it's natural, but on the other side of it, there's basically a record that deals with the fund's competitive position with other insurance companies. On the other side of it, the fund does enjoy certain advantages between the state agencies, and maybe it ought to also have the opposite. Those are the
same. If Mr. Gill argues in favor of it, would it be fair to let you argue against it?
No, I would not argue.
Chairman, how about 12?
12 is what clearly is.
You don't favor 12?
No. I think there is no statute in the nation that I know of that has any kind of administrative review provision for public records. And yet this is the one criticism that we have pulled out of the people who have written the study considerably. You know, the study is the one big hole that all public records laws have. We tried to work out a solution to that situation. I think it would be worthwhile to try it for a couple of years and see how it works out. Maybe you even want to put an additional proviso in there that I need to report the next time that there is a warrant. It has been the outcome. How many cases have we had? How many was in the result of cases? I'd be glad to do that. It's a central problem with most public records.
Please, in a nutshell, which records have been opened up under the amendment and the bill?
Right? Simply, it was sealed. Most of the ones I don't think we have added. Well, we've added a few, but the decertification and the just a matter of they have been regarded as confidential. They really, and the agency didn't have any legal authority to withhold them. They were doing it anyway. I think the bill is probably more significant by the number that we have repealed, and by getting rid of the idea that an agency really can make a subjective determination as well as we have 14 statutes that we have repealed. In addition, we had the continual problem that we had in our office. The name agency relies on, I think it was section 44, which is the executive privilege, relying on that, and which is a kind of a very loose test of balancing of interest, and gives the agency the initial determination. And I think by the repeal of that, it's more important than anything else. Mr. Papadopoulos is here. You can tell you more about that, but in his case, I had, I'll be very frank, and I recommended the agency, I said that I do not think it can prevail. On the other side, the agency had some merit to its argument, and Attorney General, I have duty, therefore, to advance it. So then the Supreme Court of Civil Defense got valid and can prevail.
Okay, ladies,
I'm
ready to go on to the rest of it, or make a call?
Chair, I really don't think. I keep the air all night on the rest of these sections, but they are are really technical amendments, conforming guidance to the first 11 sections.
Let me ask you on page 9, line 6, every public body, is that the way you want to say that, or should that be governing body?
Do we have a problem with all the city charters that exist around the state of being improperly amended to conform to this? Do you think by this bill you've spoken to all these public documents other than the state?
I hope I have, yes. I can't think of any set of records for the city council to see or county commission to see that are entitled to confidentiality. Already a clear letter of Mr. Johnson informed you're against me, but seen the amendment. I saw it on the draft. I presume that it came in the way that we expected to come in. As you probably are aware, the state action insurance fund is in a kind of unique position, to say the least, as a state agency. Finds itself in a, as a state agency, competing with a private enterprise, a very competitive arena, with well over 100 different insurance carriers in the state. We are concerned in two particular areas. The first involves the employer accounts and records that we keep. We have on file the records of each of the employers we insure. These files consist of payroll reports, records, and other information pertaining to the employer's operation, which probably some other sections, the same information would be considered private and included under Senate Bill 2157. Department of Employment collects similar information, and I think they're included. I think also that a couple of the other departments may collect the same kind of information, the payroll records, and that would be excluded. As you know, we collect premiums on the basis of payroll by classification, which means that we're going in, auditing an employer's accounts, and keeping those kinds of records, which would normally be considered very private. And I'm sure would be concerned that a number of employers would say that this information was public to their competitors, or possibly to somebody else wanting to know information about their business. So we are concerned from that aspect of our relationship with the employer and this kind of private information. Secondly, we're concerned about the information that might be requested from our competition in these areas. One of the other areas, or the second area that we're concerned about that the amendment, I believe, speaks directly to, is in the area of dividends. That writing workers' compensation insurance in this state, that all carriers are required to use the same method of charging rates and the same experience rate, the competition comes in the manner in which the dividends are extended to the employer. Each carrier has their own secret dividend formula, and it's highly confidential. It is only understandable from an actuarial standpoint to another insurance carrier. And it's the type of thing that you use in order to develop a competitive profile. Not being able to keep this type of information confidential would seriously jeopardize the competitive position of the fund. And also, I think, would jeopardize the cost factor, I think, of working with compensation insurance in the state of Oregon because of that. It would allow, for instance, a particular carrier to come in to analyze the dividend formula and schedule, to develop a formula that would direct itself to a specific block of business that was desirable for him that would competitively possibly be harmed by knowing beforehand what we might do. I suppose to the same basis that the business are developed on exchanges that they give them formula each year, kind of keep everybody guessing. Those are the two areas we're concerned about. We feel there are concerns. We feel there are concerns that protect not only the employers, the state, but also the program of workers' compensation. And I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Any questions?
Have you seen them?
I haven't seen the amendment from Mr. Johnson. I saw the draft that we worked out this afternoon, and I presume it's yeah.
And you, are any of the records of your competitors open to you in these areas?
No, they're not. These areas are considered, again, confidential in the insurance industry. The only way that the competitor gets this information, that we file this information, of course, under control of the insurance commissioner and also the Workers' Compensation Board. The third agency, called the Rating Bureau or National Council, collects the employer's information. And it's not in the specific form that we collect it, but information on policy, date, ending, experience rating. In order for another carrier to get information about an account, they have to have authorization from the employer that you can get this information, and then it's given to them not by the individual carrier, but by just that information that's given to the national council, but only upon authorization of the employer. It does not include the payroll information, only experience rating and total premium pay.
Are you an expert in field information?
I know enough about this here.
You might chair the committee, I won't call you. Anything else, Ms. Gill? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
This is not intended to be an open hearing. The closed meeting bill is not yet passed. If there's anybody from out of town, however, Mike, you want to touch on it?
My name is Mike Papadopoulos. I'm from Gravelin. I've been intending to testify right through the history of this hearing. I'm not as prepared as I ought to be because of some confusion as to the time of this particular session, or rather as to whether this particular session was open or not. So I'm just going to highlight some of the points that I remember that I did not have on my notes. I'd like to send in some material later. One item stands apart from everything else. Most of my speaking will be concerned with section 11. But if we look at section 5, stands by itself, we're talking about computer data. At that point, the mere fact that the Attorney General expands this particular language in the statutes of other jurisdictions, to me doesn't seem quite good enough. I have to know something about computers. I also have to know something about the public body, and I do not like the quote of the public body will determine which is the most convenient forum of computer output for me to use. Let's be in one case. Gone through the courts already in this kind of area, and you'll see a kind of problem. This is a case where the county clerk, I think it was the New Mexico district, was asked to provide information, voter registration information. And he provided in one way and only one way, namely printed out computer material. One of the parties, I don't know which one of the parties, was interested in having that material in the most convenient form so that you might sort out the voters' names, quick and convenient, perhaps by alphabetical, perhaps by sex, perhaps by street. It likely what the demand was for the material to be provided in usable form, either on French cards or on magnetic tape. So that the party who was asking for the information might then pay for its own computer to sort out the material and use it to set that back. The point there was that the information was already published. The information was already in the public computer. And the court said it was not for the clerk to say which way was the best way for the public to receive that. Each computer is capable of turning out information in a number of different ways. It all depends on which button you put. It may depend on a slight, small amount of program. The person wishing to know what is in the computer in a particular program is able to describe that program. He may ask for it to be printed out according to alphabetical order. He may ask for it to be provided for him on a magnetic tape. He may ask if the computer is capable, which was provided to him on punch cards or in one of the various possible ways. And so the language that I would like to use, rather than allow the public body to determine which form the data shall be provided, I would like to see it say that the data shall be provided in a form suitable to the computer, in any form at the request of the person seeking the information, and I would put in the payment. Printout costs money, magnetic tape costs money, punch card costs money. I think it's for the person who's using that information to advise you. Use the fact that that information is already at public expense being placed in the computer. Some clerk has taken raw material collected by people, turned it into punch cards, turned it into machine usable information. And I would like to see the public surprise that work has been done. Now I turn to section 11. You will remember, and I think you'll be well to dwell on the cases which have already been heard in this state. I'm not going to dwell on my own case because you don't already mention it, but there's been one really big case in this state on public records, which is perhaps a leading case in the whole United States, which came out in 1962. This really was a determinative court decision that public records were in general wide open, not only tiny records under cover, unless there was a particular case. And so we come into this section 11, and I think the phrase is all right, but it gets a little bit too complicated for my mind. I think the repetition in the about public interest going in two directions. I would try to keep the burden of proving confidentiality. I would place the burden of maintaining confidentiality if that is to be kept on the agency. I wouldn't want to see the member of the public crying out and saying the public interest lies in my being able to see this information. So I would, if I were writing this bill, I would delete the first qualifier in section 11.1 and say purely and simply the following public records are exempt from disclosure. And these qualifiers are individual sections of individual kind of state. In the first place, what your agency is called upon to do as it stands now is to say, well, we have a public record in one of these lower classes, A, B, C, D, F, and G. Are we the public agency going to decide that the public interest, even though we want them to be exempt, are we the agency the right people to decide that the public interest really requires disclosure? I'm not sure that the public agency is the best position to do that. Certainly, I appreciate the Attorney General coming in and putting himself above the public agency. There's a different kind of officer, public officer, more answerable to public opinion, more answerable to what the law actually says. But I don't think the agency should be bearing the burden of saying, pretending that it's really going honestly to look at a particular document and say, we want to keep it confidential, but really, it opens the public. I don't see any agency doing it. And that's what that first section is calling upon us to do. I think in section C, I've changed the language. I don't like the loose language of what is an unreasonable invasion of personal privacy. I think it's very fine to see that the legislature should support privacy in the right place, in the proper place. And I would, but I don't like this word of unreasonable. And I prefer to see language like, information to be exempt unless the public interest by clear and convincing evidence requires disclosure. Putting much more of a burden on the agency to say, no, because that's for courts to decide. Section D is the most important one because Section D appears to be a replacement for the privilege section which has been reviewed for before the official privilege section. In my opinion, this particular language is worse than the one that is replacing. It shifts the burden completely to the members of the public to show that the public interest clearly outweighs the public and private interest in not disclosure with the public agency that he's trying to maintain. And it still doesn't meet the problems which are available in the existing provision, the existing statute, as to what and who is really protected by the confidentiality provision. There is one kind of confidentiality which is well known, and I think it would be better to refer to it specifically. It's traditional, it's the protection of the informer. The person with information, who wishes to give information for police use. The public interest in protecting his identity is well known, is well worth preserving. That informer privilege ought to be will stand out by itself very, very visibly as a thing that's not protected. But it's not the information that's being protected, it's not the informant. The information will come out in court eventually, if the case remains. But the court maintains a policy, appears to maintain a policy generally of protecting the name of the informant in case he's going to be maltreated or mistreated in some way. But then you come to the question which is mixed in with this, is the kind of question which I come across, in which the name of the informer or the consultant is perfectly well known, but the information given to give may be confidential. And I think the legislature should be looking very, very, very carefully at what kind of information it might be the public agency is seeking from a consultant, probably a non-consultant, which it wishes to keep secret. Kind of information I can give you a model if you like, where you have a bridge or some public structure in which it is thought that it might fall down, and the state sends out a consulting report on the stability of that structure, and they go to the very finest consultant in the land, and they pay money, and he comes along and says this bridge is about to fall down, and in order to prevent panic, there's a public interest in preventing panic. The agency concerned might very well say, let's treat this report as confidential. We have the very best interest of the public in mind. We will repair that, please. We will repair that. But let me see what the case is. And so those are the decisions from the author of the Department of Confidential Information, the responsible for the information itself, whether it is confidential or not. And then finally, the other end, who is it? If you admit that there's been a confidentiality somewhere, who is it that's going to demand it? Were they an informer and a criminal actor? I think it's reasonably well established that the informer comes along and says, I will give you this information to keep my name on it. At the same time, the DA or the court appears to go along with that protection. I'm not sure if it's the DA or the court which offer that confidentiality or whether it's the informer that demands it. But in the other kind of situations where there's not an informer, you apparently have an official within the state offices who is able to, who thinks he's able to say, you tell me something, I will offer you confidentiality. Give it to your name, I think that's going to be appropriate. But it will be really useful. And that's the part I'm very familiar with that. I don't see that any state office should be going around saying, if you tell me something, you know. An opinion, an advisory opinion, that you should be able to count on that opinion to be under that. And so all the time we come back to those points have to be made. We come back to the point of where is the person? To the person. Why is it there? I'm trying to have this community that the room should be on the edge of the to explain why it does not want to say not that the agency should be there trying to say that the situation is going to find some cases and not in it. Very fine distinction. Let me just hold on a minute. I've got a lot of minutes here. And yeah, then there's that section A. I see a troublesome point in the idea that by classifying documents as advisory and preliminary final action, the public official may in fact be covering up. Again, we haven't yet got to the point where we can generally define the decider. If the final is in general, if it's not going to be involved, that's probably not the best idea. So this particular point, if that section went in by itself, I would see the possibility that the public official might be trying to protect something against the public interest just by labeling it on. But I think it's not defined. I've used the phrase in various other places that there's no official secret act. There's no official secret act in the United States except in the military security and foreign affairs. Well, Oregon is not in the military business or in the foreign affairs business. I don't see any place for official secrets as such. The legislature gives express confidentiality to those things that think about what, to protect privacy, and all those statutes are listed. I don't think we should go any further than that. I spoke about the informer. Who's supplying the information? Yeah. I think that's enough.
All right, Mike, if you'd like to condense your remarks and
I don't know
the writing, I'll be fine. Do any members of the committee have any questions? Sorry.
That's a line.
Except one for the retroactivity.
Except for retroactivity. Okay, thank you, Mike. Does anybody else wish to appear contrary to the committee's wishes at this time? Okay, the preliminary hearing on 2157 is closed, and we'll go to House Bill, Senate Bill 15, but we'll have a 5-minute recess while we try to round up some more of our members.
The committee and the bank staff and the comments of the board meeting have to do with discussions of matters that relate to clinical review of patient care in a public hospital. I might remind you that there are about 25 such hospitals in the state, district, county, and city. The clinical committees of the medical staff range in name far and wide, and that's why the language, including but not limited to, is in there. Almost every hospital has a surgery committee, a medical committee, an obstetrical committee, an infection committee, tissue committee, and so forth. But there are a variety of other committees that all relate to the clinical aspects of the hospital. These are matters which we think should be encouraged. They're done in the interest of the patient. They're done to maintain good quality care in the hospital. And they're done to protect the patient or the public, if you will. To discourage this kind of activity would be adverse to the interest of the bill, I believe. As adversely to the interests of people promoting the bill. We do not object to the public, to the meeting, rather, the public body, the board meeting being open to the public. We're suggesting, however, that that particular part of that meeting that does relate to the medical conference or the professional conference or relates to medical matters be taken as an executive session. So we've offered amendments to Section 6. The amendment would be placed on line, or following line 6 of page 4, and I believe it's self-explanatory. Speaks to these things that are related. Now, with no more explanation than that, if I can answer questions, I'll be happy to.
Could you go through each one of the items that you listed there? You mentioned the clinical committee.
Yes.
What do you mean by executive?
Well, almost every medical staff has an executive committee, which kind of handles the business of the medical staff, relating to revision or bylaws and that sort of thing. They might have a special committee relating to the executive committee. The credentials committee investigates the credentials of doctors seeking admission to the medical staff and seeking a change in privileges awarded to them. Again, these are areas routinely held highly confidential. And the reason for it is to encourage other hospital medical staff and so forth to respond honestly to a query about the physician's performance in another hospital.
What's utilization review?
Well, with the advent of Title 18 Medicare, there came a federal requirement that each patient who is in the hospital beyond X many days, and I believe it's 14, have his records subjected to the scrutiny of a utilization review committee, and that committee is to make determination as to whether or not continued or further hospital care is needed. If the committee says no, in our judgment, no further hospital care is needed, then the Medicare payment is discontinued 72 hours following that time. The attending physician has the right to go back and appeal, if I can use that term, to the utilization review committee. A peer review committee is a committee of physicians looking at physicians and assessing their professional competence. And peer review, by virtue of Public Law 92603, which was the Social Security Amendment to the last Congress, will be done on a different basis, probably, hereafter. I say probably because certain hospital peer review committees would withstand the test of the federal law and would be permitted to continue to operate in that area. But it will change the nature of that. It may or may not be institutionally based in the future.
Are there any questions?
Your comments only apply to the public hospital.
That's true. That's true. That information now is confidential and all.
The intent spelled out here is strictly to the functions of the medical staff and not the board, the hospital board.
Yeah, I think section on page 4, at line 29, subsection 5, where it says no executive session may be held for the purpose of taking any final action or making any final decision. But here is that. The action that the board of directors, for instance, of the district hospital would take relating to medical matters would be probably one of two types. First of all, that board would review privileges granted to medical staff members annually and either restrict the privileges or deny further privileges or, in most cases, renew the privileges of each individual medical staff member. The other type of decision would relate to the physician who had been found wanting a professional competency, had been through the hearing process, and had been, in fact, in that term, found guilty. And for that reason, the board was discontinuing his medical staff services. That kind of action would have to be made, according to subsection 5, at the open to the public portion of the board meeting, and would therefore be public knowledge. I'm not suggesting that the reason behind it would necessarily be offered at that time, but at least the decision would be made at that time.
On this question of executive, I missed that. I'd like to know exactly, is there another word to use there? Is there something that we're using executive session for an executive meeting?
Well, no. The executive committee of the medical staff functions and handles the business of the medical staff. It relates, for instance, to rules and regulations of the medical staff, bylaws, changes that might be upcoming, has to do with with whether or not the hospital should spend the $40,000 for a piece of study, whether or not they're going to recommend to the board that that be the case. Almost any set of bylaws, length of staff bylaws, would bring to the executive committee any charge against the physician, indicating the preference of the surgery committee says that Dr. X has too high a normal tissue rate. That would go to the executive committee, from there the medical staff, from there the board.
Wouldn't it be easier if they got committees, which is all clinical committees, and they got committees, say all clinical executive credentials, still utilization review, peer review committee.
Well,
and then you say you find out as an executive committee.
I say it at the outset, or I said at the outset, that there are a number of committees which I have not included here. That do something. I'm sure I couldn't come up with all the names used by medical staff in the state of Oregon. There are blood transplant committees, that are blood committees, transfusion committees, there are transplant committees where those things are done, there are formulary committees and all sorts of committees that are all clinical in nature, and I think that's true in coverage.
Mr. Chairman, I have to go, and I'd like to put in my 2 cents for it if I can. I object very strongly to the exclusion of the hospital, and that's for the reasons that I stated before. And on page 4 of Senate Bill 15 of subsection D at the top of the page, it's been pointed out to me by very responsible legal counsel that the word staff member would include most of the problems that he's concerned about. And I think I objected to the change of shall to may before, so if you want to, are you changing that back, is that the motion? And I think that would be very good, and I would vote for that, and I also would vote for the elimination of the legal conference. I have to.
Are you giving somebody on the committee your proxy?
I'll give Ms. Cole my proxy.
Fine.
I will vote against the bill if you elect to exclude the hospitals, but I think that they should not be excluded for all the reasons that we went through before, but if that's the way it comes out of committee, I'll still support it.
Thank you. I know you've been a problem out there.
We discussed this matter of staff member referencing
section,
I believe it's found in section 6, sub A. Can you, you don't feel that that reference there is sufficient to take care of the staff problem?
Well, I think if it said medical staff member, I'd feel more comfortable with it. It seems to me it is related to one who is employed on the staff of an institution. Speaking out in the frame of reference to hospitals, it does not get to the kind of situation where the ordinary physician practicing in the hospital is not an employee of the hospital. He merely has privileges to I'm not comfortable with that language, frankly. Nor does it get to the other area that I was speaking of, the public meeting concept of medical staff, its committees, and so forth. Those meetings being public, no medical staff member would be safe from public scrutiny. Professional practice. The effect probably would be to discourage this kind of talent because of the potential for public misunderstanding. If I may, Mr. Chairman, to cite it as an example, if a physician who's, let's say, the general surgeon, through the medical audit process, is determined that he has a high infection rate, and that's reported at a meeting of the surgery committee, and let's say the news people are there, and the news people report that for one reason or another in the paper. Then it's later determined that those cases which caused this infection rate to be excessive happened to be dirty cases when they came in. The first offender was caused peritonitis, this sort of thing, and that he was not really in any way negligent or any way contributed to this thing himself. In that case, a retraction later in the newspaper would be ineffective, and it seems to me that certain would be wrong by that kind of public announcement. If he has a high infection rate, and he doesn't respond in a practical way to correcting it, or if he has a high death rate or some other statistical rate, and doesn't respond, then sooner or later he's going to end up through the medical staff in this process to the board and go through its hearing process. And if he's a bad guy, he's going to be restricted in his privileges or have his privileges discontinued altogether.
Any other questions? Will you introduce yourself to the microphone, please?
Yes, I'm Pete Fleischman, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Hospitals.
Thank you. Tony, do you have any comments on this matter, Chairman? Attorney General? Cole, you have a motion?
I'm going to move the adoption, yeah.
As is?
Yes, yes.
Mr. Cole, as amended, has moved to amend page 4, line 6, for the amendment he has pointed out. Is there any discussion? First caller, all those in favor say aye, those opposed, no.
Mr. Chairman, I move line 20 on page 4 be deleted. Mr. Chairman, I think this can be used as an excuse to close any meeting that anybody wants to close simply with the statement that, well, we're going to consult with our counsel. And I think it negates the intent of the entire legislation.
Well, I'm opposed to the, I was just trying to think of some amendments that perhaps might take care of the problem. Because I do think it's an essential part of the operation of public bodies, particularly those small public bodies that rely almost entirely upon the legal counsel for guidance and interpretation of the law. And I know in my experience of serving as counsel for cities and hospital districts and other public bodies, that frequently a matter that involves potential litigation will be discussed. And I can see where the concern is here, that the public body would say, well, we're going to talk to our counsel because of the possibility of litigation. And I just wonder if we can just tighten it up.
Chairman, does the defendant have a suggestion?
How about to consult with counsel on matters involving pending litigation?
Was that in the earlier language, something like that? How does some public know there's pending litigation?
Well, I would interpret pending litigation as a situation where a demand has been made, if not pursued actual trial. Frequently, you'll get a letter, the city will get a letter from someone who slipped on a sidewalk demanding payment for damages. I would classify that as a matter of pending litigation, short of suit actually being filed.
Would a meeting for that be necessary? Would the city manager just come over and talk with the city attorney, or the mayor come over and talk to the city attorney? It would not be a executive meeting necessarily, nor a open meeting.
Well, that's a problem. We can use the button council when the correspondence is written.
We'll discuss that later, dear.
Well, how about on matters that involve litigation?
I think everything the city or county does involves litigation to some extent, one way or the other, advice from the attorney.
No, I'm talking about litigation statute and command.
You mean to take the word may out, don't you think, George?
I don't think so.
That involves litigation, that's true. He says first pending litigation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you would eliminate May too, would you not? Question on the motion, Mr. Chairman. There's no further discussion.
Well, I'd move to amend the amendment, Mr. Chairman, to delete the words on line 20, page 4. Delete the words may involve. The words may involve, and insert involve pending.
Representative Cole will amend the motion to delete the words on line 20 of the may involve and replace it with involve pending.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is an improvement, but I don't think it gets really to the heart of it. I don't think it's necessary. My discussion.
Question. Those in favor of the amendment, amendment, say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Representative Pollack?
You want me to call?
I don't know, I thought it was legality.
I don't think we ever.
Are you voting no for the last time?
We don't have that.
Mr. Benjamin?
No.
Mr. Benjamin?
No.
No.
Question on the previous motion.
Mr. Benjamin?
No.
Mr. Benjamin?
Aye.
Mr. Benjamin?
Aye.
Mr. Benjamin?
Aye. Mr. Chairman, I move that section 6, sub 4, lines 25 to 28. Be amended to, as each one of us has in front of us, with the word shall substituted for the word may.
Mm-hmm. Line 25 and 27.
Right.
Change may to shall.
May to shall.
Is that the only change?
And
yeah, that's all.
Line 27.
Yeah, that's all.
Also, may to shall.
There's two amendments there.
Representative Engel moves it. The word may in line 25, line 27, page 4, the Senate Bill 15 be stricken, and the word shall be replaced. Any questions that you
can raise? Mr. Chairman, I think it makes the whole thing relatively ineffective with the making it permissible rather than mandatory. And I can see many circumstances, I'm sure, if the committee can, where an arbitrary public body will discriminate against the news media in this area, and they will not be permitted in and when there is no excuse for you to keep them out. Well, we have rules set up for executive sessions, Mr. Chairman, and I think when it shall, these rules would apply.
Not for that.
For the news media.
Under section governing the disclosure of information.
Once they're there, anything they want to disclose, they can disclose. It seems like
we discussed it at a considerable length, Mr. Chairman, and
agreed by the governing body.
And agreed, as it says, the rest of section 4 down there, says an agreed to the governing body and representatives of the news media. It is assumed that the understanding will take place before the meeting begins.
Chairman, I move to amend an amendment.
You want
to amend it? By adding, deleting the period after media and adding the following words. Prior to such executive session. Reach their agreement. The thing here by three shall in this way. If they shall agree.
I wouldn't have an objection to that.
Well, I would prefer it otherwise. I would prefer it naked, but if I can't get it naked, I'll take it with this.
Okay, Representative Cole amend the amendment to include a 9:28 a.m. period prior to such executive session. Any more discussion? Clerk, please do.
Representative Cole?
Aye.
Representative Dale?
Aye. Mr. Chairman, I would like to amend section 8, lines 10 to 11, page 5, as follows.
We're going to vote on the amendment.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I move to amend section 8, lines 10 to 11, page 5, as follows. No decision shall be voided by the court because of a violation of this act unless such decision violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
Any discussion?
Can I copy of that?
There is a copy of
April 15.
Now
I've
got it.
Here we go. Really?
Where are they? Amendment to FC 15, April 15. As a reason, line 10, if there's no decision shall be voided by the court because of a violation of this act, then stand on after that. And such decision violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
Mr. Chairman, this language comes from legislative counsel, and the question, the language, addresses itself to the problem of what would be equitable relief under the Act in Section 8. You have an internal contradiction. Sometimes the only equitable relief that might be possible would be to overturn an Act. So they're saying that in something that involves a right, something that's not internal or administrative or procedural and not dealing with those things that are exempt. But if a city council were to go in and rezone some property in violation of the Act, and there was no possible way to overturn that rezoning, or if not that, I see the Attorney General is waiting to get some other question where there may be a problem or a violation of a right. The person would have a harder time getting relief.
What you said helps me understand that there is not a complete analysis of what this means. That's why I asked the question before. Now, for example, did the other law, not this act, create the right? Is it a violation of another law, not this act, that we're using to overturn the decision to invalidate it? Or is it simply and only a violation of this act, not the other law, which we are allowing to be the basis for overturning the decision?
It would be the former, not the latter.
If that's the case, maybe we should say unless such decision otherwise violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law or And I think that makes better sense. I would like a better two sentences, but as far as I'm concerned, that covers that puts the court in the right ballpark. Unless such decision otherwise violates the rights of any person vested or arising under any other law. What we're really trying to do is say that the first part of Section 8 does not mean that the guy's got a right for some other reason, for some other law, he's out of court. That's what we're really trying to say. I think the word otherwise will do it.
Right. Mr. Attorney General, did you have a comment on that you'd like to make?
I am quite confused by the line. Well, how about backing off and stopping the sentence the way it reads now? No decision shall be voided by the court because of the violation of this act, period. How
However, nothing contained in this section 8 shall deprive a person of a right vested or arising under any other law or ordinance.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Are you suggesting a period after circumstances or after report?
After report. What they even in the equitable power, they could void an action in a extreme situation. I really would have to be a very serious situation before any court of dialogue would take that action.
I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Chairman, one of the reasons we put that last sentence in is because of the concern of there being continuing attempts to override previous actions of the council, city council or school board, whatever it might be, which might throw out a bond issue.
The Attorney General has in mind a different one of the three objectives that I asked about.
Yeah, I think that's an improvement.
sent it in there, Bob. Every ordinance, any city or county pass is going to be acting on that.
It's only take care of it. Okay. I'll buy it, Mr. Chairman. I withdraw my original motion and suggest change it because of tolling. With a period after act.
So that would make no difference. No decision shall be voided by the court solely because of violations of the act.
Representative Ingalls moves to amend item 11, page 5, striking, pardon me, adding the word solely after court. Any discussion? Clerk will call
the roll.
Aye.
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 We have another amendment.
The legislature to conduct a continuing study of the open meetings law with particular emphasis on the exclusion and exemption provided in the law, and if considered advisable, make recommendations for additional legislation. I'm not sure what the proper form of something like that is, if the committee believes that it's a good idea.
Well, that judge in New York said no one's property is safe when the legislature is in session, so every time we're in session, we could change it anyway, and that's all that says is. And expressing intention to look at it to kind of think it out and look at it.
I don't know, would you, why
would
you $900
to get a bill printed up to talk to anyway? Yeah. It doesn't add anything to the law.
Well, I don't think
we're all going to law. Mr. Chairman, I'm really confident in this.
I would suggest that since Mr. Carson is the advocate of this, that it perhaps would be well advised to wait until he is here to promote it. So we'll lay that. I hate to use the words on the table, but we'll postpone action on this until Mr. Carson is present. Lay it aside, all right? Pardon? I'll entertain a motion to. Representative Cole moves that we re-engross the bill and send it to the floor of the House for a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cole?
Aye.
Responsibilities, April 23, 1972.